It's the N-Right edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, money and politics, our unbalanced society, and the United States of Alex, one lobby group that has captured America. Let's begin episode 298.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross-sort politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of dark stuff. We are away from the cosmos to know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We've traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. This week, I thought I'd share a series I heard on CBC's The Sunday Edition about money and politics. First, management guru Henry Mintzberg says Western society has become deeply unbalanced. Our politics, economy, and social policies are dominated by the interests of the private sector, while government shrinks in size and influence, and the public interest goes unheeded. He makes the case that while communists may have put the collective good too far ahead of personal good, our current government has placed far too much emphasis on the individual at the expense of not only society and the state, but also to the detriment of the individuals they claim to benefit. Let's listen in.
One hears a lot about balance in politics these days, about finding the right balance between the economy and environment, the right balance between security and civil liberties, between the rights of victims of crime and the compassion and rehabilitation for the offender, the right balance between tax cuts and government spending, and, of course, a balanced budget. Now, it might not take a great deal of cynicism to suggest that after the political calculations have been done, the balance rarely works out to 50-50. My next guest argues, in fact, that our politics, economy, culture, society, and institutions are wildly out of balance, and the result is corporate might, diminished government, and a demoralized, disempowered populace. In a slim but weighty book called Rebalancing Society, Radical Renewal Beyond Left, Right, and Center, Henry Mintzberg calls for a new social, economic, and political equilibrium, one that would benefit people, the planet, and the political process itself. Henry Mintzberg is the Cleghorn Professor of Management Studies at McGill University. He's the author of 18 books and 160 articles. He is an officer of the Order of Canada, and among his many other honors, he was named Distinguished Scholar of the Year by the Academy of Management in 2000. Professor Mintzberg joins me now from our studio in Montreal. Henry, good morning.
Good morning, Michael. Thank you for that lovely introduction.
Well, thank you for coming back. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. Now, listen, the first line of your book reads like the first line of a manifesto. I want to read it. Enough of the imbalance that is destroying our democracies, our planet, and ourselves. Close quote. What is out of balance, and what is that doing to our democracies, our planet, and ourselves?
You know, it's interesting because the balances you talked about were sort of back and forth. I think of them as a kind of pendulum balance in the sense that they're not really balanced. They're just swinging back and forth. And our politics have, for years and years, been swinging back and forth. So we suffer either pendulum politics, left, right, left, like France does or like England does, or we suffer paralysis in the political center, which is what's been happening in the U.S., the way I interpret it. So in a sense, if you've got a stool, you better balance it on three legs.
Right.
And communism taught us that you can't balance a society on the public sector leg, and what we're learning now is that you can't balance a society on the private sector leg. And I talk about a plural sector, people call it civil society and so on. I think plural is better because they go together, public-private plural. And we're going to have to straighten that part of our society out, and that's where I think change is going to have to come.
You write that in the 1989 unraveling of the communist bloc in Eastern Europe, it's been mostly interpreted, I think, as a triumph of capitalism. And you had Francis Fukuyama, for example, call it the end of history. You say that's wrong. You say if it was not the triumph of capitalism, then what was it?
It was the triumph of balance. Because if you look back, I'll take the United States because it's been taking the lead on all these issues. If you look at the United States before 1989, and particularly post-war, the public sector was much, much stronger. Presidents like Johnson introduced all kinds of social, quite far-reaching social welfare. The distribution of wealth was much more even. The taxation rate on the wealthy was much higher and so on.
The war on poverty, that was...
Of that, exactly. We forget about all that. And because of this nonsense, that the belief that capitalism triumphed instead of balance triumphed, we've been going out of balance ever since on the side of the private sector. I'm all in favor of business and private sector. I'm not in favor of it dominating our lives to the extent that it's been and dominating the debate on global warming and just about dominating almost everything.
Okay, so we had a brief interlude of balance, and now something more imbalanced now. Does that explain why Western democracies, those governments, they seem intent on reducing their own size and their own importance? Is that part of it?
Yeah, sure. People get the government they deserve, and the Americans, who for the most part don't much believe in government, get the government they deserve too. If you constantly put down government, if you constantly starve government, then you're going to get rotten government. But that includes police forces, and it includes military, and it includes all kinds of things. Of course, the military gets exempted from all this in the U.S. But if you don't have strong government, just in terms of regulation, for example, look at what's going on in banking. You had five of the most major banks in the United States pleading guilty to criminal acts. It's mind-blowing.
In manipulating the currency.
Right.
Yeah. But how did it happen? How did it all come to be? Was it a gradual thing or something done at a stroke or what?
I think it's some things like this have been going on, but they've been held in check. Once the Berlin Wall fell down, and my belief is the Berlin Wall fell on us, basically, all of us, everybody. Once the Berlin Wall fell, everything was open, and that favored private sector interests. So what you have now, for example, is tremendously powerful global private sector forces with virtually no or very little global regulation. And it's on every front. I mean, you name it, whatever it is. It's just accelerating in one particular direction, income disparities in many countries, not just the U.S., in many countries.
But I don't understand. You're going to have to help me here, because I thought a lot of that could be laid at the feet of globalization, not the collapse of the wall.
Well, globalization essentially got a free rein after the collapse of the wall. See, my point is that with the collapse of the wall, the belief was that capitalism had triumphed.
Right.
And somehow capitalism came to be associated with everything good in society. Capitalism is a way to raise funds to finance corporate enterprises. It's not the be-all and end-all of society. But this assumption that capitalism triumphed, or as some people call it, including I think Fukuyama did that, call it democratic capitalism. And notice what's the verb and what's the noun. We've been going nutty ever since. The U.S. Supreme Court, in probably the most abhorrent decision of all, just opened the door to corporate and private funding of elections. And it's become obscene. It's crazy. America is losing its revered democracy at an accelerating rate right now.
But part of that revered democracy has always been an emphasis on individualism in the U.S. Does that mean that America and other capitalist societies suffer from an excess of individualism?
Yes, but a healthy society balances individual needs and collective needs and community needs. And America, ironically, if you look at de Tocqueville, who wrote about democracy in America in the 1830s, he placed a considerable emphasis on what he called associations, essentially plural sector organizations. He went so far as to say that American democracy really depended significantly on those self-organizing institutions, which were not public or private, but communal, basically.
There's an element in the book that I want to pursue because I've been interested in this. We've done programs on that. You write that humans, us, have become human resources in the economy. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a common term, right? Every company has an HR department, sure. A human resource department. It's all part of what I describe as this domination of economic thinking. So we're not human beings, we're human resources. We're like resources of the corporation. When the corporation has a resource it doesn't need, it throws it out. Well, that's what's been happening in so many companies. You don't make your expectations on the stock market, so you fire 5,000 people. I call it bloodletting. You satisfy the stock market by throwing the bones of your employees to the wolves of Wall Street. You know, we talk about human assets. We talk about human capital. You know, apparently the airlines early on used to refer to self-loading cargo. and that's pretty funny. But you know what? If the term human resources was not so common, if people heard it for the first time, the reaction would not be dissimilar. It's kind of like, who are you calling a resource? I'm not a resource.
But we're constantly told, or we hear all the time, that the stuff that the economy needs from us in order to succeed or grow, it needs higher education, more skilled workers, greater flexibility, all of that. And it raises the question, does the economy serve us or do we serve the economy? And who does the economy benefit anyway in the last place?
Well, the economy is not an end in itself. Human dignity, human decency, human development are ends in themselves, and the economy is a vehicle for doing that, for creating employment, for providing us with goods and services, and so on and so forth. But the tail's wagging the dog now, so that the economy becomes the be-all and the end-all of everything. When Fukuyama talked about the end of history, he basically described liberal capitalism, or whatever you want to call it, as sort of perfection. Somehow we'd achieve perfection thanks to our greed. Thanks to the fact that we're driven almost exclusively by greed. It's madness.
But if we want a way of life of high standard of living and so on, and we want to pass that on to our children and grandchildren and all of that, don't we have to have the kind of economy that will expand and provide that?
Sure, but we don't have. But the economy that provides that is not the American economy that belittles a large proportion of the population. The economy that does that, that treats people decently, protects them where they need to be protected, and so on. The Scandinavian economies are doing very well, thank you, with a lot more welfare and a lot more decency and a lot more balance. Same thing in Germany.
Is there a limit to growth?
Well, on this planet, yeah. We could always migrate to another planet, but until we're ready to do that.
Okay, the reason I ask that and put it that way is that because the economies and economists always seem to be talking about growth and how we have to grow in order to get the things that we want.
Well, that's easy to address because we can grow in quantity or we can grow in quality. Economists don't know much about quality, but they know a lot about quantity. So, you know, and all their measures like productivity and so on are all numeric. It's hard to measure quality. But you can imagine, you know, you go to a restaurant, you like the restaurant. How can it grow? Well, it can open 3 more restaurants or it can become a chain like McDonald's, or it can serve better and better food. There are different ways of growing.
You write about externalities as being part of symptomatic of this skewed balance that you're talking about between corporate and public interest, corporate and public good. What do you mean by externalities? And remember, you're talking to someone who needs small words here to understand.
Yeah, well, that's an economist's word, like productivity and all the others. Essentially, it means that you engage in a behavior which results in some offsetting costs that you're not responsible for. So, you know,
give me an example of that.
I smoke a cigarette and throw the butt out on the street. Okay, it's convenient for me, and the cost of picking that up falls on the whole society.
And then when you get lung cancer, the cost will fall on society.
That's also an externality, right?
Yeah.
And so unless you can measure every consequence of what a company or we ourselves as individuals do, because we throw out garbage like mad, all of us, down the chute it goes, out of sight, out of mind, unless we can measure all these things and attribute them back to people, then society has to pay the price. So if a company fires 5,000 people, a number of whom have been dedicated, loyal employees for decades, and some of those employees have nervous breakdowns, their families break up, and so on. Too bad, you know, it's not our department, it's not our responsibility. We have the right to fire people, and that's it. We have no obligation for people who have been working decently and doing decent stuff to maintain them.
But how do you attach blame in situations such as that? And with the cigarettes, how do I know if it was Lucky Strike that gave you the cancer or Philip Morris? I mean, how do you deal with that?
Well, for one thing, you deal with it judgmentally, and for another thing, you deal with it ethically, I think, in the sense that you start to look at behaviors that maybe can't be measured but are clearly dysfunctional, and you start to question those and challenge people who do it. You know, Michael, what we're loaded with now is what I call legal corruption. Legal corruption. Now, things that are obviously corrupt, but you don't get thrown in jail by doing them. There was a famous article in the New York Times about Goldman Sachs that through some maneuvering, not illegal, captured some of them, a significant part of the market for recycled aluminum, and because of how they manipulated it, they were getting money every time that aluminum was moved from one warehouse to another. So they were shifting these aluminum ingots around all over the place and sucked $5 billion out of that market. And the companies that make cans or Coca-Cola, yeah, used cans, were angry about this. So and Goldman Sachs said, correctly, we broke no laws. Well, there should be laws to make sure they did break laws. I think they got out of it because they were humiliated by this particular situation. But we've got to call people and companies and all kinds of organizations and governments and you and me and everybody else to task when we're doing things that are dysfunctional in society. And in the meantime, it's just become rampant.
That's interesting you bring that up, because in terms of this question of externalities, on last Monday, the IMF issued a report that said that fossil fuels are subsidized to the tune of $5 trillion a year globally, because the energy companies, fossil fuels, they don't pay for health care or environmental costs of pollution or climate change or any of that. That's the kind of thing you're talking about.
Yeah, sure. That's the free market system. It only works where you can measure.
What about the idea of corporate social responsibility, corporate citizenship, and so on? Business talk about this all the time.
It's a wonderful idea that will not get us out of this mess. I applaud it when it's honest. I think we can use more of it. I'm inclined to say to the chief executive of any big corporation that wants to be socially responsible, get out of my government. Get out of our government. Stop lobbying. Stop manipulating. I don't measure Walmart by how green it is. I measure it by what it's doing in the back rooms. Same thing with their conference in Rio on global warming, where the energy, you know, the oil companies were making lots of nice statements about global warming, but what were they doing in the back rooms? And there's too much of this kind of lofty ideals and lowly deals going on in society, and we've got to stop that.
My guest this morning is Henry Mintzberg. He's a professor at McGill University in Montreal, the author of several books. The most recent is called Rebalancing Society, Radical Renewal Beyond Left, Right, and Center. This morning he is in Montreal. Henry, there was a favorable article about your book in Globe and Mail, and it said that it was an unlikely rant to be coming from a management expert. That almost suggests the imbalance itself, isn't it? The presumption that it'd be strange for a business expert to advocate for the public sector.
Well, first of all, I don't see myself as a business expert. I'm a student of management and organizations, and all my research has been about business organizations, hospitals, governments, every conceivable kind. Doctors Without Borders, the Red Cross, I've been in all kinds of organizations. So I'm not particularly a business expert, although I cherish business for what it does functionally. For us, I'm more of a management expert. But frankly, go into a business school and take a good look at the faculty, and you'll find an awful lot of people who kind of have those norms.
All right, we've talked about a culture. It's a kind of corporatist way of thinking, or a corporative society. Is that what we become in this country?
Yeah, I think that's the right label for it. Corporations are amazingly dominant. We've got a federal government now that encourages that and supports that and doesn't care much for a lot of other things.
Okay, I'm glad you raised that, because we've been talking about corporatism and corporations and so on. Let's talk about politics now, a little bit about governments. What is the underlying fault line as far as imbalance in government now?
The fact that it's been so co-opted by private forces, either willingly in the case of a Harper government that kind of loves it, or unwillingly to some extent in the case of Obama, who probably would like to see more balance. He's obviously not anti-business, but he'd like to see balance. But the degree to which money has co-opted politics in the U.S., but in many other places too, is mind-blowing. But, you know, government isn't only co-opted by domestic forces like that. It's undermined, or overwhelmed, I think is a better word, by the globalization forces. Look, if you name the powerful international agencies, the ones that really have influence, they're all economic. There's the IMF, there's the World Bank, there's the WTO, the OECD. Those are the powerful ones. The others, WHO and so on, don't have nearly the power, or the UN for that matter, don't have nearly the power that those institutions are. And they're apologists, largely, for private forces. The World Trade Organization has done some, I think, hideous things with regard to so-called protecting trade, but it's not protecting trade, it's protecting the big players. You know, we talk about a level playing field in economic development. You know what a level playing field is? It's a field in Timbuktu where the New York Giants take on some high school team. You know, Ethiopia, wherever it is supposed to throw open their markets and everything will be fine. You know what? No major country ever developed by throwing open its markets. Not the U.S., not Canada, not Japan, not Great Britain. No country, no major country, there's small ones, but no major country has ever developed by throwing its markets wide open. And that's what we're forcing on poor countries.
But hasn't money, lobbies, power, corporate power, private power, they've always influenced the political system, haven't they?
Sure.
Now, what's so different now? Is it to the extent or the degree?
It's the extent, it's the size and the power, which is much greater. Our global corporations are much bigger and more powerful than they've ever been. You could go back and sure point to all kinds of periods where these things happened. You know, Americans, I have wonderful quotes in the book from both Thomas Jefferson and Abraham Lincoln about how the corporations, two centuries back, how the corporations were the problem. And Lincoln even talked about them destroying democracy.
So did Teddy Roosevelt, and he went after them.
He had success because that was a period in the Great Trust of the late 19th century when things were really out of whack. So they straightened that out. Could they straighten it out today? You know, in 87, there was the Montreal Protocol to deal with the ozone layer, and they agreed to do it, and that problem was largely resolved. Look what's happening today with global warming. It's laughable. Conference after conference.
All right, well, then let's talk a bit more about politics. I want to look at Alberta for a minute because they've been turned upside down politically, right? I mean, the Tories thrown out after 44 years and so on. Is it good that people, that there's enough ideological flexibility, they can elect a right-wing government for decades and then flip over to a left-wing government? Or is that imbalance itself? Or what does that say?
Well, it's kind of charming. It's not that a lot of people are looking at this and thinking of Harper and smiling. It's just amusing that Alberta, of all places, you know, but I was speaking to somebody yesterday from Alberta, and she's saying, you know, we're not the knee-jerk right-wing reactionaries that everybody in the rest of the country thinks we are. There's all kinds of people. She said, raised in a farming community, she said, you know, we think for ourselves. Farmers think for themselves. And so they said the hell with it and elected an NDP government, which is not a particularly NDP government. I mean, it's not, you know, this is hardly the flaming left wing, you know.
Except Alberta, the private sector in Alberta is dominant, isn't it? It has been for decades.
Well, we'll see what happens now. Frankly, no government anywhere these days, including this one, can do much to stop the power of corporations. That's what concerns me. That's why if we come back to social responsibility, it's not going to solve our problem because there's so much corporate social irresponsibility going on. Corporations aren't going to solve these problems we're facing. Governments aren't going to be solving them for what we were talking about, all the domination of the private sector. So we've got to get to another sector.
Is there a centrist way of doing politics now? Is there, that's not left wing or right wing, it's called, I guess it's called the mushy middle. Mr. Harper and his government likes the idea of polarization, but is moving to the center part of a solution?
This may be fine, but I prefer not to use that vocabulary, because center implies somewhere between left and right. And,
yeah.
and I think a healthy society doesn't find a compromise between left and right, between state and markets. I think a healthy society finds a balance between individual needs and collective needs. Individual needs represented largely by markets or the private sector, not exclusively, and collective needs represented by the government for protection, for example, and communal needs. And so it's not the center. I see it as a kind of circle that's on the cover of the book with three solid pillars that keep that circle like a stool, keep it stable. A surprising number of countries are experiencing either pendulum politics back and forth between left and right, each one canceling out the other, or paralyzed politics in the middle. So I prefer not to think of it as paralyzed politics.
All right, let's go to that other sector that you mentioned earlier, and that which you call the plural sector.
Right.
What is it? What is it comprised of?
Well, the simple answer is it's everything that's not government or business, or every institution or association, that in other words, every organization, whether it's formal or informal, that's not business or government. And that includes specifically co-ops that are owned by their members, you know, whether it's Mountain Equipment Co-op or whatever it is, we all belong to co-ops, and they're not owned by investors, they're owned by either the suppliers or their customers or their workers, depending on what kind it is. And then you've got what I like to call non-owned organizations. Greenpeace is not owned. Harvard University is not owned. McGill University is not owned in the sense that the government funds it, but it doesn't own it. And there are a lot of those. And then there's all the social movements, like we saw in Tahrir Square on Wall Street. And then there are what I call social initiatives, Meals on Wheels programs and all kinds of things. And it's not all good or great. I mean, the Nazi movement was a community movement. And the Chamber of Commerce, which is fine, but it's an organization that represents business, is also plural sector because it's member owned in a sense, kind of like a cooperative in a sense.
But I don't understand what the sector could do. I mean, as you've just pointed out, they're variegated in so many different ways in so many different areas. How do they work together? How do they?
You know, there's so many different interests. There's so many different issues they deal with. How do they get together? And I say, you know what? If you take each of the examples I talked about earlier, take the Grameen Bank as a social initiative, and take Doctors Without Borders as an NGO, and take some co-ops, what almost all of them are interested in, they have different issues, different focus, but common concern. Concern, which is imbalance. You know, when people were out on Wall Street, the press had a field day with, well, they don't know what the heck they want. They're there for everything. Not true. Not true. Most of them were there because of imbalance. That was clear. So take India before Gandhi became active, and they had common concern, or most, but they didn't have common effort until Gandhi mobilized them. Same thing with the United States with the fathers of the revolution. So people, when they're pushed to the wall, are capable, and it almost always comes from the plural sector, are capable of uniting to change things.
But
that's what's got to happen.
Okay, but in those examples, it required leadership. And one of the hallmarks of these groups, the Wall Street group and Occupy and all that, they were proud of the fact that they had no leaders.
They need a particular kind of leadership. I'm a fan of what I call communityship. Communityship means you're there together, you're working together, you're collaborating and cooperating. The leadership is really to mobilize that, but to tap into what's there naturally. You know, Gandhi didn't create all this. He had ideas like the Salt March and so on. And that mobilized the people. So it may take individuals, for sure, not always. You can't point to one or two individuals for the American Revolution, you know, who started that. Nobody even knows who was released from the Bastille in France. Although I should add that I don't think revolution is the answer, because it usually brings a new kind of imbalance. I think it's more people uniting together to redefine how things are done, not through force, because usually force just brings another kind of imbalance. You know, Russia got rid of the Tsars, and they ended up with
Lenin.
Stalin. Yeah. Stalin more than Lenin.
Yeah. Is there any society, are there any societies in your view, where all of these things are in balance or are close to the public, private, the plural, are all sort of in balance?
Well, there are better ones and worse ones. Canada used to be that way. It probably still is, except for these guys in Ottawa. But Canada's always been exemplary in that regard. Certainly a number of the Scandinavian countries are pretty close. Germany would be pretty close. The country I'm fascinated with is Brazil. I do a weekly TWOG, a blog from tweet to blog, and I did one on Brazil. I talked about the why not people of Brazil. You know, they'll do anything. Why not? Sure, whatever. And they're wonderful. They're absolutely wonderful. So somebody wrote to me, the only negative comment I got was a guy from Argentina and said, are you kidding? Look how corrupt that country is. I should have written back to him and said, well, you should know, coming from Argentina.
Yeah, right.
But the fact is, it's got problems. Of course it's got problems. But if you look, or it's in the book too, if you look at some of the amazing things that that country has done with regard to HIV/AIDS and with regard to ethanol and gas tanks and all kinds of stuff, it's amazing. And these are all, most of these things are cooperative activities across the sectors. So if I'm going to watch one country carefully in the entire world, it's going to be Brazil.
As we wind up here, let me ask you this. You're a teacher. You teach and you associate with young people. And you see them all the time, every day. And told people break down the doors to go to your lectures. I don't know if that's true, but what do they do? Do they go to MSF or do they go to Goldman Sachs when you present the facts as you see them?
Well, the answer is obviously both, and the ones who are going to Goldman Sachs don't line up for my classes. But I teach mostly people in mid-career. We have.
Yeah.
You know, our masters, our international masters in practicing management is for practicing managers in a very novel way that tries to push management to be much more humane and much more effective in what it does. You know, this week I'm talking about the epidemic of nasty management that's all over the place and inundating us. But I just did a MOOC, you know, one of these big, massive open
right.
online
yeah, yeah.
courses, and there we were involved with a lot of young people, and they are impressive. I mean, the ones who are attracted to that, they are really concerned, and they are doing stuff that's amazing, absolutely amazing, just in Montreal.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you, sir. I think we should get you back again.
With pleasure, Michael.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Henry Vinsberg is the Cleghorn Professor of Management Studies at McGill University. His new book is called Rebalancing Society, Radical Renewal Beyond Left, Right, and Center.
I hope you found that as compelling as I did. We'll return after this break.
Stephen Harper's reckless cuts to home mail delivery are hurting the most vulnerable in our society. Senior citizens and those with mobility issues are disproportionately affected by these cuts, all while Canada Post is making millions of dollars in profit. Postal workers are campaigning to protect quality jobs and public services in our communities. The post office belongs to you. Join the fight today at SaveCanadaPost.ca.
Subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes. Subscribe via iTunes or at RadioFreeThinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@RadioFreeThinker.com. Understanding empowers you.
And we're back. Back to money and politics. This clip focuses on the American Legislative Executive Council, or ALEC as it's called. This nonprofit is almost entirely funded by giant corporations like the Koch Industries. And it doesn't just sway public policy. It seats politicians and big business at the same table to draw up laws. Laws which said politicians propose, often unedited, as legislation. Lisa Graves, Executive Director of Center for Media and Democracy, talks about the power of ALEC, how it subverts democracy, why, as an obvious lobby group, it still maintains charity status. Let's listen in.
It should be the power of our vote, not the size of our bank accounts, that drives our democracy.
That was American President Barack Obama from the State of the Union Address of 2013. Now, the connection between money and politics is not just an American predicament. However, corporate interests in the U.S. arguably have been more sophisticated in their methodology. Take, for example, ALEC, A-L-E-C. That stands for the American Legislative Exchange Council, an alliance of elected politicians and corporate bigwigs. It has been exerting its influence on the political landscape in the U.S. since its beginnings more than four decades ago. Few voters had ever heard of ALEC until 2011. That's when the Center for Media and Democracy first launched a campaign and a website called ALEC Exposed. Now, despite this, ALEC has chalked up political success stories, and it has done it not by focusing on the U.S. Congress, but by successfully lobbying state legislatures. ALEC's efforts have resulted in new statutes revising everything from gun laws to environmental protection, health care, education, and minimum wage. Lisa Graves is one of ALEC's fiercest critics. She is the executive director of the Center for Media and Democracy. That's the group that first waged war on ALEC. And she joins us this morning from the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison. Ms. Graves, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
Not at all. It's good to have you with us. Let's talk, first of all, about the membership of the American Legislative Exchange Council. How big is it?
ALEC describes itself as the largest voluntary association of state legislators in the country. It has nearly 2,000 state legislators. That's about a quarter of the elected state officials in the country. But what ALEC really is a body of unelected state lobbyists who pay far more than the $50 a year that those legislators pay for membership. And those lobbyists, which number in the hundreds, actually vote as equals with these state legislators behind closed doors on ALEC task forces, where they vote on model legislation, model bills to become law.
And those dues or fees could run from $2,000 to $25,000 a year. Is that right?
That's exactly right. And in some ways, the more they pay, the more they get, because ALEC is a pay-to-play operation where corporations pay for a seat and a vote on these task forces, and they also can pay more to have audiences, basically, with these lawmakers, where they're the entity presenting information, one-sided information, to these lawmakers, who then turn around behind closed doors and vote with those same lobbyists on legislation to change people's rights.
They actually vote.
That was the astonishing thing. One of the things that distinguishes ALEC from other lobbying organizations, aside from the fact that ALEC is actually a charity that had told the IRS that it engaged in zero lobbying, but the thing that really distinguishes ALEC is that ALEC is a body where state legislators actually give unelected lobbyists, corporate lobbyists, special interest group lobbyists, an equal vote to themselves on these model bills. It's astonishing.
Tell me the IRS didn't buy their argument that they're a charity.
The IRS has not issued any public statement about the complaints that have been filed against ALEC with it. My organization has submitted evidence to the IRS based on open records filings we've done in states across the country in which ALEC actively lobbies for bills, describes
sure.
itself as pushing those bills, wanting those bills enacted, and then congratulates and thanks lawmakers for doing so, which is the definition of lobbying. So we await a ruling from the IRS. In the meantime, we continue to gather information about ALEC's operations.
Is it only Republican politicians at the state level involved? You have, I think, 27 Republican-controlled legislatures in the states.
Well, ALEC describes itself as a bipartisan organization. When we launched ALEC Exposed in 2011, we counted the 104 ALEC legislative leaders who lead in the states or lead these task forces, and 103 of them were Republicans. So it's nominally bipartisan. It's largely Republican.
Do the politicians who are members, do they pay dues out of their own pocket, or are they subsidized by the party, or what?
One of the things that was astonishing in our investigation was that some of these lawmakers are too cheap to pay the $50 per year themselves for these sort of window dressing dues.
Come on,
and they
really?
Have
they won't
really.
$50? It's a lunch.
They have the taxpayers pay it for them. And so in a number of states in the U.S., taxpayers are paying that $50 fee per year for ALEC. In some state legislatures like Iowa, one of the whole houses of that state was basically dragooned into membership because the Republican leadership insisted on paying for all legislators to be members of ALEC, whether they wanted to or not.
And getting value for their dollars, I'm sure. Why the focus on state governments instead of the House of Representatives and the Senate in Washington?
Well, there's two answers to that. The first is that ALEC was created in the aftermath of a memo by Lewis Powell, who was then the U.S. Chamber of Commerce's general counsel and who became a Nixon appointee to the U.S. Supreme Court. Lewis Powell issued a memo calling on businesses to get involved in all aspects of government. They believed that the Nixon administration was anti-corporate, was not protecting corporations enough, believe it or not. There were some environmental rules moving. There were rules to protect wages and workers. So Powell urged these businesses to get involved in both state and federal government, and ALEC was an outgrowth of that call to arms 40 years ago. But ALEC does have influence within Congress. A number of ALEC bills have been introduced in Congress, and most notably, ALEC has alums in Congress. So there are a number of lawmakers, nearly 100 of the 535 members of Congress have basically cut their teeth in ALEC, and then they became leaders in Congress. For example, John Boehner, the Republican head of the House of Representatives, is an ALEC alum. Eric Cantor, who was his second-in-command, was an ALEC alum and was a recipient of a big award from ALEC for doing its bidding, basically carrying its agenda. And some of the most controversial senators who came into office in 2014 are ALEC alums.
Now, the people in ALEC write legislation. Is that right?
ALEC acts as a conduit for the corporations. The corporations, their lobbyists, their legal teams basically write most of the legislation. And then ALEC basically hands those materials to the lawmakers, sends it to them, and helps these two parties come together, which is why Congressman Mark Pocan has called ALEC a dating service.
But just to be clear, the lobbyists actually write the words. Is that right?
Yes. Yes.
And then they hand out the bill to the legislators who will then vote on it.
Under ALEC's rules, it's an equal vote. And so lawmakers can try to amend those bills through ALEC. Those amendments can be basically voted down by the corporations. And if the corporations don't support the bill, it won't go forward. It won't come out of the ALEC task force to become an ALEC national agenda item. What we've seen is that these ALEC lawmakers will introduce a bill, try to fast-track it, prevent the public from having a say in it, do fast hearings with little notice, have hearings in which the lawmakers aren't paying attention to what the local people think needs to be done, and then have a quick amendment process where they basically vote down any amendment that would be contrary to what was already previously voted on through ALEC, which basically renders our legislative process to be a sham.
This is a quote from an ALEC director who said, quote, "The goal is bringing state legislators together to talk about best practices around the country," close quote. That sounds okay to me. Democracy in action, isn't it?
If they were just talking about best practices, I think that would be interesting. In fact, they are a vehicle for advancing an array of disinformation. Just last year in December, they had a whole session on the greening of planet Earth and how increased CO2 would be good for you. How, in fact, we should be burning more carbon fuels, for example. You know, debating is good. I just don't think corporate lobbyists should be able to vote in a democracy as an equal with lawmakers.
I want to get into some of the specifics a bit later on, but what is wrong with the idea of corporations weighing in on draft legislation? With the Citizens United decision in 2010, your Supreme Court, that case ruled that corporations are people and can spend as much money as they want. Why shouldn't they have a voice at the table?
Well, this is an interesting question. One of the questions is, if they have a voice, how do people know that they have a voice? And traditionally, in the U.S., certainly in Congress, if you're going to lobby for a bill, you have to register as a lobbyist and disclose the amount of money you're spending lobbying or the fact that you're spending money lobbying.
Right.
What's happened through ALEC is that these corporate lobbyists go to these ALEC meetings. They're at fancy resorts often. They aren't basically registering as lobbyists for the purposes of those ALEC meetings. The ALEC contacts are not reported. These lawmakers, for example, in Wisconsin, a lobbyist cannot buy a lawmaker here a cup of coffee. That's how strict the rules are on sort of influence through gifts of lawmakers. But through ALEC, these lawmakers are getting wined and dined at corporate expense by these corporate lobbyists. And then they're asked to thank these lobbyists for basically making their trips to ALEC meetings possible.
But what's the difference whether a politician, elected politician, sits in an ALEC meeting room drafting a bill with the lobbyists or sits in the legislature drafting a bill?
Well, I do think that both examples point to, in some ways, the lack of access that ordinary Americans have to their lawmakers and the extraordinary access that powerful influences have to lawmakers, whether it is through an ALEC meeting or in a legislator's office. But one of the things that's happening with ALEC is that these corporations can basically take a tax write-off for their involvement in ALEC because it's a nonprofit charity. And then ALEC, in turn, does not report to the IRS that it engages in any lobbying. In our view, it's a deeply problematic, legally questionable, if not illegal, way in which they're doing it.
Is there an essential difference, in your view, between what ALEC does and what, say, Ralph Nader does or what Common Cause does? Some of the lobbying groups on the left side of the spectrum.
I think there's a definite difference, one of which is disclosure. Those organizations, Common Cause, Public Citizen, they disclose their lobbying. ALEC actually told the IRS that it engaged in zero lobbying for years. ALEC also told the IRS that it didn't spend a dime on trips for lawmakers when our open records requests revealed a spreadsheet that ALEC provided to lawmakers showing it was spending at least $500,000 on trips.
That's because it's a charity like the Boy Scouts.
Well, that's their claim.
Okay.
That's their claim.
Let's get specific here in some areas that in which ALEC has had an impact. Laws, for example, affecting the flow of oil to the U.S. from the Alberta tar sands.
That's an area in which Canadian companies have paid money to ALEC to sponsor events with these lawmakers in the United States to urge them to oppose efforts to restrict the pipeline. And also that's an example where ALEC facilitated trips for lawmakers and then instructed them to thank those lobbyists for the trips, but the public was not told that those trips occurred.
But there are ranchers down through Nebraska and South Dakota and so on who do not want this pipeline. How does ALEC deal with them?
You know, I would say ALEC tries to roll them. That would be layperson's way of dealing with them. In essence, what has happened with ALEC is that you have a wide array of citizen action on a number of issues, including Nebraska farmers who don't want the pipeline to run through that aquifer. But ALEC basically sort of cuts out the middleman in some ways by having these lawmakers almost become the lobbyists for these industries. And so they're not really listening to their citizens in many instances.
What about the gun laws, the carry laws, the stand your ground law in Florida, for example?
That was an example where we took a close look at that after Trayvon Martin was shot. And initially,
this was the young black teenager who was shot and killed.
Yes. So in Florida, the person who killed him, George Zimmerman, was not arrested initially. And people were wondering why. And we knew, because we'd published all these bills and had analyzed them, that bill was originally pushed by an NRA lobbyist who was closely connected to ALEC. That NRA lobbyist took that bill, the so-called Stand Your Ground bill, to two Florida ALEC members. They introduced the bill. It was signed into law by Jeb Bush in 2005 with the NRA lobbyist looking over his shoulder. The NRA lobbyist then took that bill to a closed-door meeting in Texas and introduced that bill to the ALEC task force, asked it to become a national priority. At that task force, Walmart was the co-chair, the corporate co-chair of that task force, and Walmart is the largest seller of rifles in the world, at least private seller. And it is the largest retailer of bullets in the world. At that task force meeting, corporations, special interest groups, and lawmakers voted unanimously to push that bill forward. And from 2005 until 2011, that bill spread across the United States. And ALEC bragged about how much it had pushed that bill to become law.
Walmart has since changed its corporate mind, though, hasn't it, about that?
Probably, yes.
And Michael Bloomberg, the former mayor of New York, has targeted that kind of legislation.
Yes, in 2012, Walmart stepped out of ALEC. It said that it did not want to be a member of ALEC anymore. Around that time, ALEC said that it was going to stop pushing these gun bills, but it has done nothing to get those bills repealed. And in fact, ALEC was pushing both Stand Your Ground legislation along with, you know, closed carry, concealed carry legislation. And so you have more people who are armed who are given this license where they are to stand your ground, which typically is a privilege that people have in their home. The reason why you can stand your ground in your home is because you have nowhere to flee. You can't necessarily, you know, call the police. So
I always take the view when I'm in the U.S. that everybody is armed. So I just to be on the safe side. Lisa Graves is my guest this morning. She is one of ALEC's fiercest critics. She's the executive director of the Center for Media and Democracy. And we are talking about ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. Another area they've been successful, I think, union activity, especially in Wisconsin, in your state.
ALEC has a long-standing agenda to try to crush unions. They have numerous bills that are designed to weaken or block union activity. And when the sort of ALEC majorities came into power in 2010, as the Tea Party was gaining power in the U.S., the immediate effect of that was that these ALEC legislators started pushing bills to take away union rights. Here in Wisconsin, which is the home of the public employee unions in the United States, the place where they started, they really wanted to basically have a what might be called a decapitation strategy of really trying to kill unions and union activity where they'd be considered historically the strongest in Michigan, Wisconsin, and the other manufacturing, main manufacturing locations in the U.S. where they had grown. And so ALEC certainly backed those bills and was happy that they were pushed to make it harder for people to organize. And there's been an effect in the state of both, you know, lower union membership and also lower wages in many respects.
Do they make political contributions? For example, would they have contributed to your governor, to Scott Walker, who has fought the public sector unions?
ALEC doesn't, although it did form a PAC many years ago that sort of went nowhere. However, Scott Walker is an alum of ALEC. When he was in the state legislature in the 90s, before he went to the county office that he held before the governorship,
right,
he was active in ALEC and he was active in pushing ALEC bills. And he gave interviews basically bragging about his working with ALEC.
What has ALEC done in terms of climate change legislation?
ALEC is really one of the most powerful influences in the U.S. in pushing climate change denial. That's in part because it has access to so many lawmakers, and it has been actively pushing